Chapter 2, Initial Assessment.
So now we're going to go through the rest of our discussion on TIA, and we're going to work through that case that we heard at the top of the episode. What'd you find on exam?
So on exam, he's oriented, he looks well.
What is his NIH stroke scale?
So his NIH stroke scale is 0.
And his symptoms are totally resolved now?
Pretty much, yeah. All resolved. He looks well.
So just to recap, we heard at the beginning of chapter 1, we heard the history from this patient. Just as a reminder, he was playing softball, and then he had this sudden sensation of a tingling on the left side of his face, and he described a heaviness on the left side of his body. And while that's not a total slam dunk for it being a TIA, it is something that patients will commonly describe as what they feel when they're having a little bit of motor weakness. They may just say it feels kind of heavy. And then tingling, you know, that could be paresthesia, but sometimes patients who have decreased sensation when they touch their face, it feels to them like it's tingling, even though it's decreased sensation. So I think this is pretty suspicious for a TIA. And just as Dr. Lee said, his exam right now is totally normal.
Yeah, I actually agree. The fact that both of these symptoms are on the left side, I think definitely heightens your suspicion that this is a stroke TIA type syndrome. It's vascular territory, at least for sure. And definitely people are going to use different words to describe a motor weakness. And sometimes they get the motor and the sensory confused, actually, I find. They say that they have trouble feeling something when it actually is a motor weakness when you go to examine them. So for sure, I think that the suspicion has to be pretty high here. One of the things I would definitely want to know, though, going back to our original discussion, is the timing of this. Was it sudden in onset? Could we pinpoint the exact time in our mind? And do we have a time course for how long things lasted?
Yeah, and I can clarify that for you. In discussing it with him, he was able to figure out which inning of the softball game he started feeling the symptoms, and then it resolved about one inning later.
Oh, you've so got to say it was from the top of the third to the bottom
right.
of the fourth? Is
yes,
that what you're saying?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So we said, it was probably somewhere around 15 minutes that he had these symptoms.
Right, and that turns out to be pretty significant as we go through our discussion.
So what elements of the history are really important here? Well, it's what we've touched on. This is a clinical diagnosis. The patient's going to be normal as they're sitting there in front of you. So it's all about finding out exactly what were those deficits. How long did they last, and do they follow an anatomic pattern? And then as you examine the patient, of course, you want to make sure you're doing a very thorough neurologic exam, which goes above and beyond the NIH stroke scale. That will miss some subtleties if that were all that you did. And you want to make sure that if they had a prior stroke, which is something you're commonly going to see, that they don't have any worsening of their baseline deficit.
Yeah, you know, this one is really, really tricky, Jess. Because as the patients get older, a lot of them have had strokes before. Sometimes they've had multiple strokes, and it can be very difficult to sort out what is new and what is baseline, especially because when people get sick, for whatever reason, they get pneumonia, they get a UTI, urosepsis, they tend to have an exaggeration of the upper motor neuron deficits that they had before. And so sometimes in order for me to really be convinced that there's something new going on, I need more than just a, you know, this seems a little bit weaker in this left upper extremity than usual, but that is where the stroke was. It really helps when you have something new, like a new facial symptom, a new limb. That really does help convince you that there's something new going on. And there's no easy answer to this. Sometimes if the deficits are quite severe, you have to get help and you have to consider that it could just be a worsened stroke in that same area, but it can be really tricky.
Now, another thing that sometimes residents may miss is checking for upper motor neuron lesions, which I think is something we should talk about.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important because some of these patients that seemingly have completely normal power, normal sensation, normal reflexes, really a stone cold normal neuro exam after their report of what sounds like a TIA, will have an upper motor neuron sign, like a plantar response. It's upgoing, a Babinski sign. And that can be golden. If I see that, and it's on, for example, in this patient that we're talking about, if everything seemed normal on exam, but I see that there's an upgoing plantar, for example, on that left side. Hey, that's a really strong sign. Hey, this is probably upper motor neuron stroke related.
TIA mimics.
Now we need to talk about TIA mimics, which we largely covered in the stroke episode last month. But Stuart, let's discuss some of the really important mimics that we need to know about.
Well, you know, the way I think about mimics in TIA, Jess, is exactly the way you do, which is that it's a total overlap with what we've talked about in stroke mimics. But there's a couple of differences. And one of the important differences is that, hey, remember earlier how we were talking about these patients are similar to syncope patients because they look mm-hmm. fine in front of you, but something really scary happened to them?
Yep.
Well, you know what? Syncope is a major differential of TIA. And so although we don't tend to think of syncope as a differential of stroke, it's not really a stroke mimic, it totally is a TIA mimic. And so in addition to all the things that we had to think about with stroke, like was it a glucose problem? Was it a sodium problem? Was it an infection, vestibular syndrome? All those mimics that we talked about with stroke, we have to add a big one when it comes to TIA, which is, hey, was this not something neurological at all? Was this something cardiac? Was this an episode of VTAC? And so I put syncope right up there, high on my list when I'm looking at someone who's thought that they had a TIA. You know, obviously when someone comes to you and they can clearly report that they had a slurring of their speech and that they had weakness of their arm and it's all consistent and they remember the whole thing, I'm not really thinking syncope. All right. It's not in the differential diagnosis, but there are a lot of people that say something really scary happened and I felt I couldn't move. And well, those are the people that if you explore it a little further, hey, maybe there was a loss of consciousness. Maybe that's part of it. And that overlaps with seizure, of course, as well. And so it all comes down to the finesse of the history. Just be aware that syncope is something that has been missed when TIA is on the menu.
Two of the other ones that are right at the top of the list are a seizure with Todd's paralysis. We talked about before is that that's a really common mimic that fools us. And a complex migraine, which is so fascinating when you see someone, especially if it's their first presentation of having a neurologic deficit with their migraine. That's really hard to diagnose.
So for metabolic abnormalities, you could easily have low glucose being a mimic of a TIA. That happens. But the history is going to be helpful. Did they get some sugar and did it resolve, for example? But you have to consider the electrolyte abnormalities. Sodium, calcium are often implicated. These are less likely to present as TIA and more likely to present as stroke. But, you know, you got to keep an open mind.
Of course, any sort of brain lesion, whether it's some mass or infectious lesion or blood. And that's why we're getting that CAT scan right up front.
For sure. There's a whole bunch of other things that mimic stroke and also TIA, like MS, mm-hmm. other demyelinating diseases, acute vestibular syndromes. It's a huge mimic for people that are getting vestibular symptoms as a dizziness presentation. Peripheral nerve lesions, like, for example, ulnar neuropathy that's intermittent, for example, might be something that presents as a TIA versus as a stroke mimic.
And then, of course, psychogenic, which, again, diagnosis of exclusion, not something we're diagnosing in the emergency department, but just something to be aware of as another potential mimic.
Absolutely.
Now, when a TIA follows a clear vascular territory, that is a much easier diagnosis to make than often what we get in real life. So say the patient says, oh, I had sudden onset of a right-sided facial droop, and I couldn't think of words, and my right side of my body felt a little bit weak. And the whole thing lasted 15 minutes and then it was completely gone.
Yeah, so exactly. So that totally makes sense for a left-sided middle cerebral artery territory stroke because you've got right-sided weakness, right-sided facial droop and body weakness. And then that, which is, you know, in the left hemisphere, and the left hemisphere also does language. So that all makes sense. And that's the common constellation that we see together. But as you know, the kinds of stories that we get are often less razor sharp clear. And you're left wondering, hey, it's got some features that sound like it could be a vascular territory, but others don't really fit.
So Stuart, why don't we go through some examples, like real world examples of what patients really say? And then let's discuss whether or not we think that was a TIA or a mimic. Does that sound good?
Yeah. Okay. Let's do it.
Okay. So first case, this is like real cases that I've seen recently. Someone comes in, brings in their elderly father and says, my father nearly fell. He seemed weak and he was acting out of it last night. I don't know what it was, but I think it was maybe a TIA or a stroke.
Okay. So with that one, way too vague. I don't see anything, for example, that localizes to a certain focal area. He's feeling weak. That could be any number of medical things. I don't know if that's from his anemia or from a global metabolic problem or if it's a focal neurologic problem. I also don't get the sense of a sudden onset of something. I'm not convinced about that. I'd like to see a certain time where we have a deficit and being out of it, well, you know, that certainly could be part of a stroke syndrome, but again, it's not enough. It's too vague. So it's going to take a lot of drilling down and getting some specific things before I'm really going to be going down that TIA pathway for this gentleman.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a patient who needs more of a general medical workup.
Okay, Jess, I have one for you. A recent patient I saw was a middle-aged woman who said that her right hand was numb off and on all day the prior day.
Okay, so the first sort of clue that that's probably not a TIA, although you would think, is this sort of stuttering symptoms? They've had these on and off symptoms for a whole day. But the clue for me is that it's just the right hand. So I would definitely want to clarify whether or not it involved her arm as well. But if it just involves the hand, then I'm thinking it's probably more of a peripheral lesion or a carpal tunnel syndrome, for example, and less likely a TIA.
Okay, so you know, you do the full exam and you'd look for upper motor neuron findings, but if on your exam you found, hey, there's some specific deficits in the ulnar nerve distribution, or I can find some carpal tunnel signs and nothing else, you might be able to go just hit down that peripheral pathway.
Right. All right, Stuart, I got another one for you. So this is an elderly woman. She's in her 70s. And she says that yesterday in the evening, she suddenly felt dizzy. She vomited 3 times. She felt really weak. And now it's completely gone.
Well, this one actually really makes you take pause, because she's admittedly a little bit older and you're getting a sudden onset history with the dizziness. Now, as you know, dizziness most often is not something life-threatening. But when someone with risk factors or that's older says that they have a sudden onset of dizziness, they get my attention. And so I'm going to be delving into that one a lot more deeply. I'm going to be checking very carefully if she's got any other cranial nerve, either findings or on history, suggestions of a cranial nerve problem, and a really thorough exam to see if there's any other long track findings involved, because I've had a low threshold to work up this woman.
Right. And I think the big concern here, just to bluntly say it, is did she have a TIA affecting her posterior circulation, a vertiginous TIA?
Exactly.
Now, Stuart, there are some types of TIAs that most people, myself included, wouldn't necessarily consider in the category of TIA. So let's talk about some of these more exotic, rare causes of TIA.
Well, I want to make sure that we don't get pigeonholed, that everything that is in the distribution of a vascular territory that looks like a neurologic event is from atherosclerosis or from an embolic process. There's a few other bad things that present just like a TIA where the treatments are actually quite different. The first one is endocarditis. If a patient has a TIA type presentation, but they also have a fever or they have indwelling lines and they're set up for bacteremia, of course, they could be having bacterial plugs that are flipping off their endocarditis that are causing TIAs, and antibiotics are pretty critical to their treatment.
So they're having basically septic emboli going to their brain, which we wouldn't normally think of as a TIA, but essentially it is. It's just a weird type.
Exactly. Another phenomena that requires special mention is cervical artery dissection. Dissection of the arteries, either your carotids or your vertebrals. When that happens, and there are people that are susceptible to that, like for people with Marfan syndrome are susceptible. You can get that with some minor trauma, even with yoga has been described, or with the chiropractor's office manipulation. And those patients might present with neck pain and stroke-like symptoms, as the dissection actually serves as a nidus for a clot to form there. So those patients might present with a TIA-like syndrome, but what they really need is vascular treatment to address that torn artery. And so that actually sometimes requires a anticoagulation, ironically, or a vascular surgery consult.
Okay, so their little dissection flap is throwing off little thromboemboli to the brain, causing TIAs.
Exactly.
Got it.
The third thing is temporal arteritis. Temporal arteritis is a vasculitis. It's a problem with inflammation in the blood vessels, but that inflammation happens in blood vessels that, when they're blocked, cause strokes. And so sometimes, again, the etiology of the blocked vessel isn't an atherosclerotic or embolic phenomena from vascular disease. It could be from an inflammatory disease. In that case, the treatment might be corticosteroids. And so they can present just like a stroke. A temporal arteritis patient can present with amaurosis fugax, which is that curtain-like TIA, that patients have a curtain-like deficit in their vision. And if you don't recognize that there's actually an inflammatory etiology for that, okay, that you will miss the fact that they need steroids as part of their treatment.
Okay, so an arteritis causing a temporary ischemic event, blocking off the blood flow to either the brain or specifically the retina, as you mentioned with amaurosis fugax.
Last month, we talked a lot about stroke mimics because when you have a stroke or you think a person's having a stroke, and particularly if you are going to give them something really nasty like thrombolytic therapy, you better be sure that it's a stroke because those drugs are associated with significant side effects. And if you're giving it to the wrong person, that's a big bad deal. It's not as important in TIAs, but you do want to make the correct diagnosis so that you can get these patients, you know, the right imaging and the right follow-up and the right therapy. As we've said, TIAs is no longer considered sort of a benign thing. Don't worry about it. It's considered a, hang on, if I intervene, maybe I can prevent this person going on to have something worse. So just sort of going over that list again, remember that seizures can look like TIAs, that metabolic problems, particularly low glucose, can produce focal abnormalities, brain tumors, obviously, demyelinating diseases, CNS infections, acute vestibular syndrome, peripheral nerve lesions, radiculopathies, and of course, even sort of the psychogenic thing. But let me just state for the record, in case it's not obvious, it can be really hard to work out what's going on. And even sort of trained neurologists with all their residents and their fellows and their registrars around the bed taking a history often have a hard time teasing out exactly what went on. Was this just sort of a weird little thing that grandma had? Or was it really a TIA? Or was it a seizure? Or was it something else? It can be very hard, and the only way you're going to get to the right answer is with a really good history and a good physical and talk to the people who may have seen the event. And even then, you may not be 100% sure. So don't feel bad about it, but at the same time, don't fall into the, oh, well, it's too hard, I'm not going to try. Get a really good history, really good physical, and think about what else this could be. And that will get you on the right track to finding the right diagnosis.